Hello, and welcome to The Assembly Line, Dev Bytes. I'm your host, Kevin from Kahan Games, and I'm here to present to you another pretty awesome interview that I had the pleasure of conducting. First of all, I want to thank everyone for letting me know how you felt about the last episode. I thought it went well, and all the feedback I got was super positive, so I truly appreciate you guys taking the time to let me know what you thought. So we're just going to keep the good times going here. I think I introduce him when the interview starts, so I'm just going to play the interview. So let's get going, and I'll see you on the other side. So I'm here with Matt Hewson. You might know him from such titles as From Below or Witch and Wiz, and this is pretty exciting because it's the first time I've ever spoken to him. So how you doing, Matt?
I'm doing great. Thanks for having me. Excited to be here.
Absolutely. You are sort of in rarefied air because you not only do NES homebrew, but you also actually work in the game industry, right?
Yeah, that's correct. I've been doing it for about 15 or so years, I think now. Yeah.
And what are some titles, some modern titles that people might know you from?
I worked at EA for a while, so pretty much all the sports titles. Worked on some smaller things, a game called Prototype 1 and Prototype 2, which some people know, but it's a little lesser known. Worked on Dying Light, which was kind of a spiritual successor to Dead Island from the Techland guys. And now I work on, for the last 10 years or so, working on Gears of War.
Crazy. And you actually helped develop the online lobby system for EA sports titles, right?
Yeah. Yeah. When I was at EA, I was on the... We basically had a central technology group that did all of the online systems, because back then it was like PS2, so there was no like friends lists and stuff like that. We had to build it all from scratch.
Man, that's crazy. Yeah, games have come a long way.
Yeah, definitely since like that time. After that, I feel like it slowed down a little bit, but like 360 was kind of establishing a lot of patterns that are still around today. But yeah, that like PS1, PS2 generation was... PS2 especially was pretty, like, just figuring out what online is, Dreamcast, that kind of stuff.
Yeah.
Yeah.
All right, so let's go all the way back to young Matt, young Canadian Matt. Yeah. What's your earliest memory of video games?
I think the earliest thing I remember doing is playing Atari. I had a ColecoVision. Like the Atari attachment, I guess. I don't really know much about Atari stuff, but I'm pretty sure that's how it worked. So yeah, that was the first system I ever had, was basically a 2600 for the most part. And then there were a few ColecoVision games that we had. Smurfs, I think, was one of them that was pretty good.
How old were you at this point?
I don't know. I would have to, like, I was born in 82, so I'd guess like 4 or 5, probably. I think at that time it was already pretty dated. I think my dad just got it out of like a dumpster or something like that, or off a friend who was like, because I remember we got it and we got it with like 50 games. Or that's how it felt at the time. So,
did you say 50?
Yeah, that's probably like my 5-year-old brain. It was probably like 5, but it felt like I just had this massive library kind of right out of the gate. I don't ever remember buying games or getting games for Christmas. So I'm pretty sure like the 2600 was basically dead at that point, and we were just getting like the dumpster diving leftovers from somebody else.
So were you putting a lot of time, like, were they a big part of your life at that point?
No, not at all. I think it's hard to remember because I was pretty young at that time, but I remember, like, I can remember pieces of it, but I think it was probably a little too complex for me. I can remember we had a flying game, Pipe Dream or something like that, but it had like the reverse controls, like down is up and up is down, and that was just broke my brain. I used to have to play with the controller upside down, but then left and right were backwards. But
that was back before they gave you options play inverted.
Yeah, exactly. So like, I think I was pretty young for that. But then after that, I got an NES, which again was used. So it was a little like, it was definitely after the NES had come out, but it was, I think, during the like heyday, probably like 89, 88. Yeah. And that was huge. That was, and even before I got it, it was already like complete cultural, like Goliath. It just dominated everything in my life at that point. We'd rent it every weekend, or not rent it every weekend, but whenever I could get my parents to, we'd rent it Friday night, have sleepovers until Sunday with my best friends, play like all night as much as we can, just kind of absorb the essence of the NES as much as possible. So, well, we'd rent it for the weekend and kind of just dive in for that weekend. But then eventually, yeah, it became more common. And at that point, yeah, every friend had one. Except my neighbor, my best friend had a Master System, which was a little sad for him, but
that's cool. I didn't know anyone that had a Master System. I didn't even learn about them until later in life.
He was the only person I ever knew. I have no idea why he had one. It seems really odd thinking back. I don't know, like, what would have possessed him to get one. I suspect there's some weird story, like an older cousin had one and thought it was trash, so he gave it to him or something.
Yeah, I had a similar experience. My neighbor had a Mac, and I didn't know anyone who had Macs, and I always wondered, why would you go that route? There are so many games for PCs and things at that point, but he had a Mac.
Yeah, exactly. So yeah, anyway, the NES, yeah, that was really the, although Atari was first, NES was really where I kind of,
that's where your heart,
teeth in,
that's where video games took your heart.
Yeah, exactly.
So at what point did you think that you might want to make video games?
I don't know. I don't know if I realized it was possible for most of my life. I worked at a Blockbuster in high school, and like I would be like the game guy there, like renting and giving like suggestions and all that. But I don't remember ever crossing my mind that, oh, there's people who actually make these things that I'm renting. Like I could probably look into doing that. Until very late in high school, I actually took a year. I graduated high school, worked a year full time at Blockbuster, and just absolutely hated it and realized I can never do this with my life. I will go insane. Working retail is really, really tough. So I was like, okay, I'm going to go back to school. At that time, I don't want to get into the weeds, but getting into university in Ontario was a little complicated. You had to go for an extra year of high school, stuff like that. So I went back to high school to get that done so that I could go to university. And then in the process during that time, I found out about a school with a game design program, which was quite rare at the time. This was around 2000. And so nowadays it's very, very common. Obviously you see game design schools all over the place. But at that time it was like that my school, which was Full Sail, and DigiPen were kind of the two that were doing it. DigiPen being...
Wait, you went to Full Sail?
Yeah, I went to Full Sail. So yeah, I eventually went to Full Sail. I thought I was going for a game design course because I'd never programmed before. And it turned out to be like, just a full-on, really actually quite hardcore programming course. But it was cool because maybe you found something similar when you kind of got into programming, but you might think like you want to design games, but...
So yeah, sorry. Did they have multiple campuses or did you go to Full Sail in Florida?
I went in Florida, yeah. Oh yeah, are you in Florida?
No kidding. I'm in Florida, yeah. I had no idea you were over this way.
Are you in Winter Park or Orlando?
No, I'm in Northwest Florida, so they basically consider this Alabama. But yeah, that's really cool. Actually, I had some friends over last night playing music, and one of them went to Full Sail. What years were you there?
I think 2001, 2002.
Okay. So I think I visited him maybe... There might be some crossover there. That's interesting. I had no idea.
Yeah, was he was in the audio program?
No, he was in film.
Or film? Okay, cool. Yeah, so
yeah,
there's not
still
a ton
cool
of...
You were...
Yeah, that's cool. I really want to go back and see it again, but I haven't had a chance yet.
Yeah, we were talking about student loans how much more expensive it is these days. So that's really, really cool that you were there. But yeah, do you want to talk about that, your experience there?
Yeah, so basically, like, I went there thinking it was a game design course, but I found once I got there and learned to program that that's actually where, like, you can truly express yourself. Like, if you're a designer, it's like trying to tell a painter how to paint a picture you're picturing in your head, whereas if you can paint yourself, you can put exactly what you're imagining on the paper. So I felt like, yeah, it was quite empowering, and I grew to love programming quite a bit, and then I just stuck with it and worked in the, got into the industry and been working there ever since.
Wow. So you had no programming experience prior to going to Full Sail?
No, I think I had, I'd done websites, but like HTML 1.0, yeah. like in Notepad kind of thing. And I had tried RPG Maker like at one point, but it was kind of drag and drop. So yeah, I really had no idea what I was getting into at all.
What was the first language that you learned?
C++. So they have, I'm not sure if it's the same, but they have the idea that they kind of throw you into the deep end. The first course that you take, like C++ 101, has like a 70% fail rate.
It's Holy just
like
cow.
Insane. But they have rules that if you fail any course for anything other than attendance, you can take it again for free. So it's basically like a bit of a churn at the start. A whole bunch of people come in, a few go to the next course, and then... but the others stick around and kind of really grind on it until they get it. And the courses there are 1 month long. So they're 8 hours a day for 1 month instead of like a couple hours a day for a year.
Yeah.
So you just focus on one course at a time and you're like, you're completely engrossed in it for that month. So it's cool. Like for me, it worked well.
Full Sail is really unique because they have classes like 24 hours a day, right?
Oh yeah. It's insane. Yeah. They're like... the assembly line, like factory of schools. Yeah. They had courses at literally like 3 a.m. you'd have courses and stuff.
Ah, that's so weird.
And they try to sell it a bit as like, oh, this is like the industry and you're going like, to learn what it takes. And I was like, yeah, kind of. I haven't done a lot of 3 a.m. starts to my day, but yeah.
Do you know if other like peers at that point in your life are a lot of them, did they go on to make it in the industry? Do you know?
Definitely a bunch of them. Yeah. Like I got friends, yeah, who went on to Call of Duty, for a while. Yeah. Some guys at Raven actually who are, I think working on Call of Duty as well. Basically everyone worked on Call of Duty. No, but yeah, it was pretty good. Like there's definitely a mix. It's not a sure thing by any stretch. And like, if I went back today, I don't know if I would do it now that I kind of understand what the industry is and what people are actually looking for. Like I'd probably just do a comp sci degree if I was doing it again today and on my own time figure out how to make games. But at the time, yeah. It was kind of a, when you don't know what you're doing and you don't know how to get there, you just know a destination. It's nice to have something that says, hey, come here day one and on day 300, you'll be ready to enter the industry. So
yeah, that's one really good thing about Full Sail is they really do prepare you. They give you like, they truly give you skills to succeed if you are willing to let yourself get there.
Yeah. And I think it's evolved quite a bit since then. Like when I went, it was pretty new. And when I look at it now, I think they're doing like master's programs and all sorts of stuff. So it's probably quite a bit different from when I was there.
All right. So when did you find out that NES homebrew was a thing?
In like the... early 2000s, I got really into late 90s, early 2000s, I got really into collecting NES games. And then as the internet started coming out more and more, I got into emulation and NES fan sites and stuff like that. So I was learning about all these games I'd never heard of, playing like, realizing there's like 700 NES games, I think,
yeah.
Or like 30. So kind of exploring the fringes of the console. And then in that process, I certainly learned about homebrew existing. I think at the time I didn't really know the difference between homebrew and a bootleg and stuff like that. It was all kind of blurred Sure. together. And my impression of homebrew, and it might've been accurate at the time, was that it was really, really basic, like tic-tac-toe, like those kind of experiences. So I thought of it more as a novelty or like a proof of concept, like, hey, we can run our own code on an NES. And that's what's exciting about it. It's not the games themselves, which is cool for sure. But as like a gamer, it's not that exciting. As a technical person, it's exciting. So anyway, so that was kind of in my head. I knew the concept was possible. But then I think Micromages launching on Kickstarter, which went pretty viral, reintroduced me to homebrew and kind of got me thinking about it again. I picked up that game because I was collecting NES games, but kind of stopped for 10 plus years after kind of got everything I wanted, and other things in life, obviously. But I mean, not got other things in life, got into other things, like
right.
life moves on, have kids and stuff like that. But anyway, so Micromage kind of reignite that interest and like, oh, there's this world, like I love the NES. I have hundreds of games. I think I've kind of seen all there is to see. And now, oh, there's this actual other part of it, this homebrew world that has like this whole new set of games that I've never played. I look at them. I have no idea what they are. It's kind of that feeling that I used to get going into a Blockbuster or something, where you just see a game for the, or even GameSpot or something. You'd go in and see a game for the first time and have no idea what it is. You'd just be looking at the back of the box, reading about it, reading the manual on the way home, trying to figure out what it is. And you don't really get that anymore. Like, there's probably very few huge games that are good that you wouldn't have heard about prior to seeing it at the store, right? It's just all over the internet, Twitter, all that stuff. So to me, homebrew has that. It has that excitement of there are really good games that are somewhat unknown, at least to me. So that was really exciting. And then the next thing, maybe getting a bit ahead of myself, was your game Nescape. When that came out, which I think was shortly after Micromages, or felt shortly after.
It was pretty close.
It's pretty close. Okay, so around that time. So it's on my mind. Another one launches. I'm excited to get another homebrew. I grabbed that one and in the process found out about this podcast. And then listening to that, realizing, like, hearing you guys talk, because I went basically back to the start and worked my way through them. Hearing your guys' journey and how you were, I'm pretty sure, had never programmed prior to starting on the Nerdy Night tutorials. Yep. So hearing all that and realizing, well, I actually know how to program. Like, I feel like I could actually do this. Like, making games for the NES always seemed like a black box, this thing for like the elite of elite technical wizards, which it kind of is.
Which is not the case.
Well, it's not really anymore, but I think we're like building on top of the work that those people did, right? Like, at one point, people were in there with multimeters trying to figure out how to like get past the CIC and stuff like that. Like, that's way beyond me. But because all that work's been done, it's not like that at all anymore. It's almost simpler in some ways because the system is so confined and understandable. It's like you can mentally map the whole program in your head, which is really hard with like something like Unreal Engine or whatever.
It's interesting hearing you talk about the evolution. Like, when you found out about homebrew, it was very sort of, you know, technical achievements, people figuring things out. When Micromages hit the scene, it really did show what a polished game could be on the system. It's cool to hear that we were sort of influential in you thinking that you could do it yourself and make a true, you know, full experience, which I would say that you certainly achieved.
Yeah, like a massive influence, I would say. Like, it went from zero idea that I could do this to completely believing that I can do it and just listening to the podcast. So yeah, it was pretty great. Instrumental. I think Battle Kid was probably that for a lot of people, but for whatever reason that I hadn't heard of it prior to kind of Micromages and digging in more, but that obviously shows kind of what's possible and showing like a commercial kind of level game. And there's probably others. I'm not really a historian on this, but those ones jump out at me.
Was it hard for you to get going developing on the NES, or because all the people sort of laid that groundwork, did you take to it pretty easily?
No, I found it quite easy, actually. It was like, it's easy is maybe the wrong word. It was challenging, but totally doable. Like, it just took work to kind of work through. All the groundwork was there. All the steps I needed to take were very clear. I just had to kind of do them. So what I did was I bought a book called Making NES Games, I think, by Stephen Hug. Sorry, I should have had that ready. But yeah, I read that book. I love that book. I think it's a fantastic book. And it really takes you step by step through what it takes to make an NES game and see. And explains all the hardware quirks. And I felt like I came out of that really understanding the hardware and kind of the I could describe in words how to make a game, but I felt like I was missing the, like, okay, if I just booted up a computer for the first time, what steps would I take? Because they gave you a lot of kind of building blocks to start from. It's got its own IDE and stuff like that. So,
gotcha.
So after that, I went through another tutorial series, which was the Doug Fricker ones, the nestdug.com, which is kind of a mirror image of the book, but in a much more concise way. And everything is built with command line and like Notepad and stuff like that. It felt way closer to kind of what I'm how I wanted to build stuff, which was using kind of my own tools and, or not my own tools, but using whatever tools were available to me, not being stuck in the 8-bit workshop IDE, which the book used. So after I came out of that, like I felt like I could make anything pretty much. There's obviously like things to learn along the way. I still don't obviously know everything, but I feel like I understand what I don't know. And I think like, oh, if I wanted to use this mapper, like I understand what a mapper is. I now understand what is probably going to be involved in taking advantage of the mapper and what's going to be hard, what's going to be easy. And yeah, I feel like people have done a lot of groundwork that makes it very, very accessible for any, especially anyone who's done any C like programming. It's very, very
so straightforward. You do specifically program in C when you're making NES games?
Yes. Yeah, I do pretty much everything in C. I go into assembly to tweak, I would say. Like I'm very rarely, like a lot of people talk about, they use C and then when they need to optimize, they'll move it to assembly. I don't really work like that because assembly is pretty challenging for me because I just haven't done very much of it. So I'm more, the only time I really touch assembly is if there's something that already exists and I need it to be slightly different, like say a meta sprite rendering routine, and I want to be able to flip the meta sprites, I'll maybe do a tweaked version of that kind of thing. But I won't like say, oh, this like movement routine in C is too slow, let's go to assembly. I can't do that. I mean, I probably could do that, but it's easier for me just to optimize the C code.
How different is C from C++?
I would say generally very, very similar. It's more like C is a subset of C++. That's how I think of it. So just things don't exist.
Gotcha. I'm asking because I don't know.
Yeah, but it's like, have you used like Python or anything?
Yes.
Like that? Or Java? Yeah, it's very similar to anything like that.
Cool. So when you decided to start making a game for the NES, did you just jump right into one of your larger projects? Like, was that an idea that you just started with and saw through to fruition? Or did you start with sort of smaller, you know, smaller sort of test things to see if you could get things compiled and moving?
Yeah, I definitely started small. So I kind of made a 3-game plan because ultimately the kind of games I like making are action platformers, or action games at least. But I knew that was that's a pretty big leap out of the gate. Just even if I could program it all, just building all that content, I've done enough kind of indie games to know like it's going to be a real struggle to build all that stuff, get all that art content. So, I built, I created like a 3-game plan, which was my first game would be an NROM game that would basically just be a test game. I probably wouldn't release it. It would just be for me to go through the whole process of building a game from scratch and finaling it and releasing it for free on itch or something like that.
Mm-hmm.
Then the second game I was planning to, I can't remember exactly what my plan was, but I think it was to do another NROM game and, but make it more action based. So I'd get more of the real time experience, deal with performance issues, a bit more art and stuff like that. And then the third game was going to be using an advanced mapper. And that would be kind of where I landed on my real destination, which would be like a more action platformer game. It changed a little bit in the process. The first game I ended up making was From Below, which is a Tetris game similar to Tetris, which is NROM. It's quite simple, but it ended up getting a pretty decent following as I worked on it. So I decided to release that physically, which, oh yeah, that's right. The second one was going to be my first physical release. So, anyway, that first game ended up getting a decent following, asking for a physical copy. So I ended up going through the process of self-publishing that and learning the process of kind of buying boxes and sourcing cartridges and stuff like that. So I released that. And then the second game was Witch and Wiz. So I left NROM at that point. maybe a little earlier than I had originally planned and moved to MMC1, mostly just so I could have more memory. That's pretty much all I use.
That's
it for.
Quite the upgrade.
it's amazing what a difference that makes. I'm not using anything. I don't even know if there is anything else on MMC1. Oh, and save game. The extra RAM and save game, but no, like, graphical tricks. I still just use Sprite Zero hits, stuff like that. So that one actually started as an NES Dev competition cartridge or game, which ran on the Action 53 mapper. Mm-hmm. And then I converted it to the MMC1 after the competition to continue the development. And then, I shipped that last year, 2021, in the fall, on cartridge as well. And then, so the next one I think I'm going to do is going to be MMC3. I haven't quite figured out what I'm doing next, but I got quite distracted along the way. I started working on Game Boy games, did a port of From Below to Game Boy. I released a magazine and a couple little other things along the way. So I haven't really got too deep into my next game yet, but should start really soon.
So you self-published From Below. You handled assembly and shipping and you did all that yourself?
No, not all of it. So I basically bought the cartridges from Broke Studio. So they did all of the cartridge assembly, writing the ROMs, the stickers. They handled all that side. And then the manuals and boxes, I hired a guy. I basically found a guy on Etsy who was doing bootleg boxes.
Oh, wow.
And just said, like, hey, can you do like some real boxes for me? So he did those, and that was basically the first 50 copies I did that way, just to try it out. I really didn't like it, though. I probably will never do that again. It's a lot of work for for very little payoff, I find. So for the second 50 copies, I just got Broke Studios to do it all, and I basically sold them on my store, sent them a shipping, a list of people to ship to. Yeah, and then they took care of.
Yeah, it's such an endeavor to do it all. So I don't blame you one bit. And the more games I do, the less and less I want to do that side of things.
Yeah, exactly. Yeah, and the thing is, like, I wrote about a blog about this, but in the end, it actually cost me more to do it myself than to just hire Broke to do it.
No kidding. All right, so when you start a project, what's the first thing that you do?
I've only started a few, so I don't have like a...
You don't have a process?
Yeah, I guess I have a bit. Like, I usually start with the previous project, rip out everything that's game specific so that I'm just left with the basic kind of core game loop, maybe rendering a meta sprite. Yeah, sorry, go ahead.
Do you use an online repository?
Yeah, I'm using GitHub for everything. And I do my editing in Visual Studio Code, which is integrated with GitHub. So it's kind of all handled for me. It's quite nice. So the first thing I guess I would do is create a repository and then drop in a previous project with all the game specific code ripped out.
I do like Visual Studio. I use that for my work, JavaScript stuff. So very nice looking.
Yeah, VS Code's... Do you use, like, Visual Studio or Visual Studio?
No, I use VS Code.
VS Code, yeah. I like it. Like, I use Visual Studio at work, but at home I use VS Code. I like how lightweight and quick it is. Yeah, it's
very
nice.
Quick, very colorful. It's great.
Colorful's interesting. I don't know if I'd say
I used, I used Notepad for so long, and it's typical, very, very bare bones text editor. So
yes, I guess
having colors is nice.
Syntax highlighting is something.
Exactly.
Sure.
And I guess you already kind of talked about your mapper decision, because you sort of set your three-tiered goal of NROM and then MMC1, and you said you're trying to do MMC3 for the new project?
Yeah, after Witch and Wiz finished, I basically did a little tech demo using MMC3 to kind of recreate the train scene from Ninja Gaiden, I think Ninja Gaiden 2? I can't remember. Anyway, it's got a bunch of parallax in it. So just to figure out, like, could I actually do... Because those are the kind of levels I really want to... the kind of games I really want to make. So I just want to know like what it would take to build a level like that and how complicated it is. But thankfully, again, NestDug has like a tutorial on using that mapper with C, and it's got a bunch of helper libraries to do that kind of frame timing specific effects. So yeah, it was pretty easy actually. Thanks to him.
Are you using like IRQ stuff for the splits, or are you doing like delay loops?
Yeah, it's IRQ. Basically, like he set it up. It's pretty cool how he did it. He basically has like a little scripting language almost, and you kind of set up all your timing based on scanline hits from the mapper IRQs. And you say like, when I hit this line, I want to execute this little script of code, which are kind of assembly commands. And so like, I can just say like on line 30, scroll by 5 pixels, and it'll just do that for me automatically. I just kind of set it up.
So you are using MMC3 specific stuff.
Yeah. Yeah. For that one, it's all using like, the scanline counter.
That's awesome. Which,
doing something like that with like code timing, I don't know how you would do that in C. It would be,
Impossible. I'm running into issues right now with the Onyx game I'm working on with the parallax. I'm using sprite zero for the HUD at the top, but then I'm using delay loops to wait to split the screen at a different speed for the parallax scrolling for the background. So like all of the NMI stuff, I mean, I'm just running out of CPU time.
Yeah, so does that
mean having to wait so long to even start, processing the game engine? So I'm probably going to have to take the parallax out because right now I'm out of CPU time. So the stack is just going crazy when too much stuff's going on.
You have to guarantee that you finish all the logic before the wait loop, basically. Is that right?
Right.
Yeah, I kind of ran into that. Even with Sprite Zero hit, I think I was having issues with that. I can't remember, but. Yeah, that sounds awful having to try and do all that.
Programming sucks, man.
Yeah. Have you seen the Garbage Pail Kids footage yet?
I don't think I've seen any video gameplay. I've seen screenshots.
Yeah, so there was a video like from I think Portland Virtual Game Expo, but it's got some crazy parallax going. It's got like 6 layers. It looks awesome. You should check it out.
Well, they have a damn genius programming all their stuff, so that doesn't surprise me.
Yeah, it looks cool.
Must be nice.
Yeah, I feel you.
So do you do all your own graphics? I'm naive on your process with this stuff.
Yeah, no, I don't do any graphics. I basically hire people to do graphics and music.
Okay, so you haven't messed with any music stuff at all?
I mean, I mess around with it just to kind of be functional, but I can't deliver like a song that's like shippable quality. But yeah, I use Famitracker pretty much for everything. And then Famitone is like Famitone 5 for the runtime library.
So you are using Famitone 5. Okay. I haven't looked at 5. I've gotten up to 4.
Yeah. I can't remember what 5 added. Especially compared to 4. I was on Famitone 2 for From Below, and then Tui, the guy who does the music for me, I think he was complaining about like he couldn't control volume. He had to create new instruments for every every volume.
Got to put the volume in the instrument.
Yeah. Okay, so that sounds right then. Yeah, so he was basically complaining about that. And I don't know if Famitone 4 added that, but it's in Famitone 5. Was the reason for switching.
Yeah, I believe Famitone 4 offers the volume channel, more effects, and more note ranges. Because I know in Famitone 2, you couldn't go above a certain note and below a certain note.
Right.
Yeah. It's cool that Doug offers so many different versions of that.
Yeah. Yeah, I feel kind of like a little... Yeah, I hope people are aware that when I say like this stuff is easy, I really realize how much has been done for me that I'm not really like, sometimes I don't even feel like I'm making NES games. Like the code I'm writing could be like a SDL game, like for the most part. So I am very aware that other people have made this easy for me.
Being able to drop in a sound engine is so convenient. I can't even imagine having to write a sound engine that handles that stuff. Like that's still so foreign to me.
Yeah. I don't. I guess there's very few people that do it anymore, right? Pretty much everyone's just using libraries.
Yeah. I mean, why? Like. Yeah. Why would you? Why would you? I mean, that if people have done the legwork and it's that easy to plop in, it just seems. I can understand someone wanting to do it just to see if they can, but it's already been done so well that I don't know why you would want to.
Yeah, I totally agree. I guess unless you were doing like a very specific kind of experience, like maybe like a DDR game or something where you want kind of custom logic around your sound engine. But yeah, if your goal is just to play music, there's some really good solutions already.
All right. So when you include your data, is it binary assembly language? Like when you plop in your graphics, how are they delivered to you?
Yeah. So some of it's binary, like the graphics data goes in, is just, like just included basically as the CHR ROM, but things like level data go in as C arrays, essentially, like just arrays of numbers that I guess you could kind of think of as binary, but not really.
But they're so just when your continued. Artist delivers you a background image, like what format is that in?
Usually, like background graphics. I guess they come in two flavors, right? Some of them would be like in From Below, it's kind of a static background. So they would full static single screen background. They would basically do, build the screen in NES screen tool and deliver that to me. And then I would save that out as a RLE compressed C array.
Okay.
And cool. Then the Nestlib library, which I use, which is kind of the C interface to a lot of core assembly stuff. It has a function that just takes that array and puts it on screen. The other way obviously is like more dynamic levels, scrolling levels, stuff like that. So those I build up my meta tiles in NES screen tool to set like attributes, stuff like that. And then I output that as a bitmap, which I load into tiled editor. And then I use that to lay out my levels. I save that and I have a custom Python script that takes that level data from tiled and puts that into basically a C array in a format that I understand, which I know like the first byte is a header, the second byte is like the width and height, that kind of stuff. And then that kind of gets cross-referenced with the meta tile data that I set in NES screen tool to build up the screen from there.
Did you write that Python script yourself?
It's more or less... Yeah, it's more or less original now. It's basically all of this workflow started, though, from the NestDug tutorials. So they're kind of an evolution of that over a number of years. So there's probably still some similarities there, but it's evolved quite a bit from what Doug had. But yeah, I write a lot of Python scripts.
That's one of my favorite things, I think, is seeing like more or less all NES developers start from a tutorial that someone wrote. But everyone has developed such a unique workflow that's personalized to them specifically. I love hearing people's different sort of tools and things that they use. It's awesome.
Yeah, it's also interesting. I find that a lot of the tooling is also game specific as well, not just like developer specific. But things have to be optimized so much, and there's not a lot of room for generalization. You have to really like trim the fat in every area you can, so it leads to like a lot of, I don't know, it's just interesting to me that people have custom tools for this one game because they need the level format, and like, oh, I need right scrolling left to right, so instead of my levels like being stored left to right in rows, I'll do vertical rows so that I can kind of stream them in easier, stuff like that. I find really interesting. Kind of archaic.
And if they're only using like a portion of the screen that scrolls, so the level data is only saving that portion of, you know, the columns, and it's cool, man.
And it's very different. Like my, and I'm sure maybe you find something similar, but my day job is all about building like generalized tools and making things like easy to use for like a number of different use cases. So it's a lot of thinking like wide with problems, like what will happen if someone wants to do this? And what if the other person wants to do the exact opposite? And how will that work? And that kind of thing. But the NES development is like the opposite. It's just making bets saying, you know what? This game can never scroll vertically because I just have to make a decision and I need to optimize for one specific case. And I find that really empowering and kind of exciting to work with.
So how often with your day job and your family, and you said you have kids, how much time do you get to devote to NES development?
It's pretty rare. Well, I don't know if it's rare, but it's challenging. I try to do a few hours every day. I basically put the kids to bed, 8-ish. It's getting a little later as they get older, but 8 to 8:30. And then I try to work until 10 o'clock every day. And then I feel like if I get to 10 o'clock and I don't feel like working anymore, I can go veg out on the couch and not feel guilty, still get something done, slowly make progress towards my goals. But, that's kind of how I try to do it. I've been pretty bad lately, to be honest. I'm feeling like really tired. I don't know why, but it's supposed to be getting easier. The kids are getting older, but for whatever reason, like 9 o'clock hits and I'm ready to go to sleep. But anyway, that's generally how I try to work. I try to do a little bit every day. I don't generally, I think I heard you say you're the opposite where you'll go like through spurts where you'll just spend like full days working on stuff.
I have a problem where if I'm in the middle of a game, I'll think about the mountains of work that I have to do to get it finished. And my brain immediately is repulsed by that. So like I put it off because I know it's such a huge undertaking. So I'll have time to do it, but like I won't want to start it because it just seems so overwhelming. So I found, like you said, you have to, repetition is almost key. Like you have to sit down to just make yourself start it. And once I start it, it's sort of like an avalanche to where it's all I want to do because, oh, I knocked out this part. Okay, now I can do this part, and I do that part, and it moves on to the next part. So yeah, I'll work like 6 or 8 hours in long spurts and just knock out chunks of stuff at a time. But I'm so clumsy with my programming that it probably takes me 8 hours to do what someone else could do, you know, in 45 minutes or an hour. So I just have, you know, I'm not a graceful programmer, so I'll just say that.
Yeah, I'm similar. I do a lot of, I wouldn't say brute force stuff, but I will just try stuff and run it. Try stuff and run it. Try stuff and run it. Just over and over and slowly iterate.
If it works, it's the right way in my experience. But then this is probably the first instance where I've been running out of CPU time. So it's like, shit, maybe I should have taken the time to cycle count and write it as, you know, efficiently as I could, because now I'm paying the price.
Yeah, I imagine it's the more you get, the more technical you get, the more like planning you have to do.
Yeah.
But it's interesting too, like the stuff about motivation and all that. I find like I have the same problems you mentioned, the procrastination and seeing the mountain in front of you. I also find it so like it happens so much where I'll have those mountains in front of me, or I'll just put something aside like a bug and say like, I don't want to deal with that. Like I'll deal with that someday. And then you finally get to it and it takes like 20 minutes and you realize like, I've just been sitting on this for so long.
I could have fixed the game could be done by now.
it's crazy. And that's why I find the kind of, like you said, the repetition, like the other night I was kind of, I had to do like edit the first enemy to the game with collision detection and all this stuff. I'm like, oh, this is like quite a bit of stuff. It's going to take forever. I was feeling pretty down. And then I just sat down and did it, forced myself. And it was like half an hour. And I was like, oh my God, I have like an enemy in the game now. It's basically a real game and I can kill him and he can kill me. And
that's
like 90% of what games are. And I was just like dreading this and it was so easy in the end.
It feeds your desire to keep going. Like once you see that enemy in the game and you're like, wait, man, like it's feeling like a real game. I can see how this is going to be fun. Oh, I can't wait to put that next building block in there to just keep adding and adding and adding. And then like a month goes by and you take a step back and it's like, holy cow, like I made this. And at some point, someone's going to play this. I don't know. It's just cool that you can create something that is substantial. Like, in this world of millions of games, like, you have this thing that you spent months on or years on, like, that you can show, and you get to put this on the shelf beside Super Mario Brothers 3 or whatever. Like, it's awesome that we get to create things of value.
Yeah, absolutely. I think there's two, like, interesting things there. The first I was thinking of is, like, that the idea of getting something on the screen. I find with new people who have never made games, they think they need to shoot for the stars. It's like a common trope that they'll want to make an MMO, like, as their first game. But I really say, like, just get a sprite on screen where you can move it with the gamepad, and it'll be the best feeling in the world. You don't need, like, a Kirby's Adventure for your first game. Like, you will be happy. You'll be so amazed how cool it feels to just have something on running on your TV that you built and you can move around. It's such an empowering feeling. And just like you said, once you have that, you're like, oh, well, what if I had gravity? And what if I have to dodge, like, a bullet or something? Like, it takes very little to have, like, a little toy to play with. And it's really, really empowering and exciting. The second thing I was thinking about when you're talking about there was this idea of kind of making something substantial. And that's something that's really kind of kept me in the NES homebrew space, as opposed to kind of just indie game dev and stuff like that, where I feel like the bar to make something this is going to sound a little derogatory, but I don't mean it to be, but the bar to make something that people are actually interested in and feel is worth talking about in the NES space is quite low. Like, you can kind of make anything, and it feels much more like a community that's excited about what each other are working about. And it's not necessarily about kind of getting YouTubers' attention or, like, getting people to Twitch stream it and stuff like that. You can be, like, a big name in the NES space without being, like, a superstar, kind of like we were talking about earlier. And I find that really, really exciting after having made indie games, like little platformers and stuff, for, I don't know, 10 years or so. And none of them, like, nobody cares. You're just one in a million. But if you, in this space, you're not, you're like one in a dozen who are actually making a game this year, maybe. So it's really fun and exciting. And it's fun to work on something that people actually care about and talk about and have questions and complaints and talk about it in a meaningful way. I don't know. I find that really, really compelling and really exciting space to be in.
Yeah, I feel that it's grown leaps and bounds as far as being able to, like, there are really good games that are coming out, and I feel like the community of people that are excited about them are growing each and every year. So I think it's great. It's a super awesome place to be in, a super great position to be in. So yeah, I'm excited to see what else you come up with in the future. Do you have a vivid memory of the first time you got something moving on screen?
That's a good question. I'm trying to think. No, I don't think I do, but I definitely, like, remember the first time I got something running on my TV and, like, copied to a EverDrive and seeing it running on a CRT.
Yeah.
And, like, that was pretty special, because prior to that, it feels a little bit like you're just making a PC game, especially when you're working in C, and it's kind of, it's not that different than what you've done before. But when I actually put it in my NES and I see it running,
And you're pushing a button on the NES controller and it's working. I remember that moment very vividly. Oh, it's so awesome.
And definitely, like, seeing it, getting the real cartridges, like the retail cartridges and the boxes and the manual and all that stuff. That was quite special for sure. Like, as I mentioned, like, the NES was basically like my childhood. So it's quite a dream come true for me.
Definitely. Well, is there anything we didn't cover that you want the world to know?
No, I don't think so. That's about all there is to say about me, I guess.
Well, I truly, truly appreciate you coming on. You know, like I had mentioned, I had never, you know, we've interacted, you know, through Discord and on Twitter, but this is the first time I've talked to you. So I love that you made some time for this, and it's super cool seeing, you know, the things that you're working on, and you are a valuable addition to the NES community. That's for sure.
Well, thank you for saying so. I really appreciate it. This being on the podcast itself was actually kind of a long-term goal of mine, so I'm really, really happy.
All right, well, check it off the list.
Yeah, exactly.
I can't wait to have you back on. Hopefully when Bo comes back, we can do some game episodes and bring you on and talk about some of the games you've done.
Yeah, it'd be amazing.
All right, man. Well, have a good rest of the day.
All right, you too.
All right, see ya. Well, thank you again to Matt for coming to hang out for a little while. And thanks to you for listening to this new format. I'm going to keep going, and I think I'm going to bring on maybe, you know, a couple of musicians just to get, you know, another perspective. Because it's not just programmers that make this scene happen. You know, my first few games were garbage without... you know, before I brought on an outside artist and, you know, an outside musician, they make a huge difference. So we want to talk to some of them. So we'll see you in the next episode. Until then, if you want to follow me on Twitter, you can find me at A Ton of Glaciers. And if you want to follow Matt, you can find him at Matt Hewson. Until then, keep playing and talking about homebrew, and hopefully you will motivate me to make another episode. Thanks. See you next time. Bye.